Chapter 3. Telling the Truth About the Lie of God. Just wanted to let you know that you people are scum, and you are the bacteria that grows under a pile of shit, and David Silverman, that un-American piece of shit faggot-loving son of a rotten cunt, needs to move to another country. He obviously has no love for America and its values. I'm gonna continue to tell you people what parasitic garbage you are. Have a Merry Christmas, bunch of douchebags. An email to American atheists in December of 2012. So when I meet somebody who claims to be religious, my first impulse is, I don't believe you. I don't believe you until you tell me you really believe. For example, if they say they are a Catholic, do you really believe that when a priest blesses a wafer, it turns into the body of Christ? Are you seriously telling me that you believe that? Are you seriously saying that wine turns into blood? Mock them, ridicule them, in public. Don't fall for the convention that we're all too polite to talk about religion. Religion is not off the table. Religion is not off limits. Richard Dawkins. The sum total of all scientifically valid proof supporting the existence of all the world's gods combined is zero. Beyond the rhetoric, beyond the lies, and beyond the marketing, never once in the history of our species has any religion found, offered, or shown any verifiable and testable proof based on scientifically valid evidence and the scientific method. You know, the way we would prove anything else, of any supernatural being or phenomena. Ever. As I said before, if I am ever proven wrong on this point, I will quit my job and donate the proceeds of this book to that specific God's religion, and I shall do so in a tremendous hail of publicity so that everyone will know. Indeed, if you believe in a God, I double-dog dare you to find even the smallest fallacy-free, scientifically valid proof of anything supernatural or any miracle anywhere ever. Go. Have fun with that. I begin this chapter with a specific bet in order to exert a little firebrand atheism. The theists who read this will be motivated to prove me wrong. They will say, hey, my religion has proof, and then rush off in vain to find it, just so they can eliminate my job and be the hero for their God. They will ask for help from their friends and pastors. They will have Facebook discussions that will include phrases like, proof doesn't have to be scientifically valid. Yes, it damn well does, or it's not proof. Or, I just know in my heart, or how else can we explain something we don't understand, or God is love and love is real, so God is real. But none that will actually include the phrase, here, I found scientifically valid, testable proof, and be true. If they are honest with themselves when they fail, they will be halfway to freedom, for they will know that their religion is made up of lots of things, but facts aren't among them. What will that do? Will it get the theists angry at me for saying something against their religion? Probably. Maybe the challenge will get them really pissed off. It's meant to, because if it were mild, they would not take it to heart. I'm saying no religion has ever had scientifically valid proof of its God, even in the smallest quantity, ever. That's a bold statement, dismissing all religions as ancient mythologies and fairy tales, which they are. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and all the rest have no more proof for any supernatural phenomena than Hansel and Gretel and Little Bo Peep. Zero. With my blunt challenge, I dare their adherents to prove me wrong. I challenge their sensibilities and tilt their religion's pedestal. If believers choose to ignore this challenge, they do so knowing they cowered away from finding proof for the God to which they swear and donate. I hope that gnaws at them. But those theists who want to learn, who have the courage to confront their upbringing, might take me up on this challenge and try to find their proof. It might lead to discussion and perhaps the discovery that all religion, even theirs, is a lie and a scam. It may be discussed around large circles of theists trying to prove me wrong and failing, and then, ideally, they all get the message and escape religion, leaving them free to live happier and healthier lives. Hopefully, they will bring their friends, their families, and their kids. How much better would those kids' lives be? Yes, some of my readers already don't like me, but in the end, I'm only trying to help injured people recover, and in doing so, dramatically improve their lives. To me, that's totally worth a little dislike. Christians who don't read the Bible aren't real Christians. Yes, I'm fully aware of the no true Scotsman fallacy. Angus puts sugar in his porridge. No true Scotsman puts sugar on his porridge. Therefore, Angus is not a true Scotsman. But let's be honest. Literate but not Bible-reading believers are just posers. If they really thought they possessed the perfect Word of God, they'd read it. I certainly would. In fact, I'd memorize it. They don't read it because they fear finding exactly what they will find. It's boring, primitive, and ridiculous, far from being perfect or even good literature. So they don't read it, lie about having done so, and listen to what their preachers say without even considering that preachers pick and choose their passages to speak about, tailoring their message to grow their flock and line their pockets. The conflict of interest astounds. Am I a dick because I encourage, dare supposed theists to read their own holy books, knowing they will see the truth of their poor quality by doing so? Is this a firebrand move or a diplomatic one? On the War on Christmas. Religion demands a pedestal, and in the case of the United States, Christianity demands a pedestal higher than every other religion based solely on privilege and tradition. The so-called War on Christmas is a great example of how Christianity demands respect it does not deserve. Christmas was made a national holiday in 1870 in an act that merged religion and government with serious ramifications, the destruction of Christmas as a Christian holiday. Surely, when the law passed that made Christmas a national holiday, some felt it would benefit the church, just as it has, by legitimizing Christianity using the force of government. But the legitimacy conferred has not been able to keep up with the nation's growing diversity. What's an atheist to do? What's a Hindu to do, for that matter? Or a Jew? Or a Muslim? Non-adherents are not converting to Christianity because of the forced observance and celebration of the birth of Jesus. Rather, they are celebrating the more secular aspects of the holiday, primarily the parts stolen from other religions and practices. In turn, the non-Christian aspects of the holiday have evolved to be more and more important. This is the reason Christmas is becoming increasingly secular, to the annoyance of every Christian preacher. We saw this happen with Thanksgiving, which is now religious only in name. In the not-too-distant future, Christmas will become equally secular. This has never happened to a religious holiday that was not made into a national observance. There is no campaign to keep Moses in Passover. Christian ideologues know this and hate it because they are losing their privilege as Christmas becomes secular. They complain about stores saying Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas because the more inclusive statement doesn't grant Christianity any special privilege. Christmas goes from being presumed to be singularly important to simply one of many holidays. Stores do it because they know that 30% of the population isn't Christian, but some Christians hate it because Happy Holidays acknowledges that 30%, so they complain that Christianity is under attack. Again, equality is an attack. Every American understands the basic concept of equality, or at least they should, but we are simply not used to it when it comes to Christianity. Realize that the idea of equality to women is threatening to some men, just as the idea of racial equality is threatening to some white people, because they perceive becoming equal as a loss of privilege. This is also the case for some Christians who fear losing privilege and becoming only equal to other religions and atheistic positions. They are correct. They are losing privilege as we gain equality, but it's an unearned and undeserved privilege, and it's right that they should lose it. Christians know, deep down, they have no reason to oppose equality except their own greed for privilege, which comes from Christian hegemony. Equality is the American way, and it should not be considered a punishment or a loss when people of privilege lose their privilege in favor of equality. And if it is viewed as such, too bad. Equalophobic Christians must be called just that and called out for it. They care when a politician says Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas. It's all about demanding inequality, singling out one holiday as special over the others. A holiday tree, season's greetings. Some Christians freak out when they don't get preferential treatment. Soon, as Dennis Miller has said, quote, I won't be able to sing White Christmas without being called a racist, end quote. Or not. The end game is Christians will be treated equally. No one is calling for restrictions on what's done on private land or in churches, but we all own the government and the public square. Equalophobic Christians will have to get used to the lowly position of equality with the rest of us. In the meantime, we need to call the war on Christmas what it is. Another reason for anti-equality Christians to whine about being only equal. If someone claims to be offended by our assertions that we deserve equal treatment, it's because they are used to privilege and social superiority and actually fear just being equal. I call them equalophobes because they fear what we as a nation should be striving for. Equalophobes fear the American way. This de-religionizing of Christmas is inevitable. As long as non-Christians are forced to take December 25th off, the process will continue. It is also inevitable that the Christian right will continue to blame atheists for the decline of Christmas into secular observance, even though the fault rests with them. If they could separate religion and government, and Christmas reverted to being a religious holiday only, then it would once again be all about Jesus. But it's way too late for that. Our entire economy spins on the season, so I believe the point of no return has long passed. Christmas's religious meaning is destined to continue to decline. We can help the process along by chipping away at the legitimacy granted to Christianity by the government. By protesting the government's illegal favoring of the Christian-only aspects of this national holiday, we force the government to highlight only the secular aspects. Ironically, the act which sought to legitimize Christianity by nationalizing its biggest holiday will yield the elimination of religion from the holiday, not the religionizing of America. Of course, the equalophobia goes far broader than just Christmas. Equalophobia is why they fight against our monuments next to their decalogues, why they push their Bibles in public schools but fight it when we distribute atheist literature, and why they care so much about under God and in God we trust. Their loss of any of those issues is a win for equality, which chips away at their religion's pedestal and implied government endorsement. Christianity has good reason to fear equality. It's coming anyway. Part of the danger we face from religion arises because anyone, regardless of religious affiliation or lack thereof, can be elected to political office in the United States. I think that's a problem. I don't think we should have a religious test per se, but I do think we should have a religious priority test. Specifically, the politicians should be asked, which is more important, your religion or your country, and what happens if the interests of the two conflict? We need to make sure anyone who takes public office will place the law of the land and well-being of all citizens above his or her religion's demands. We need every politician everywhere to state unequivocally that the U.S. Constitution outranks everything, including religious texts, as the U.S. Constitution, Article 6, second paragraph, specifies. This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. All citizens have the right to their own religious beliefs and practices, but once the people place you in power, your allegiance is to the people, even if that requires actions not supported by, or even contrary to, your religion's teachings or interests. If a conflict arises, are religionists willing to put their religion aside in the name of the country they are swearing to uphold? If so, no problem. If not, the person is simply not qualified to take office. In a religion versus country debate, the country wins all the time. This is the only way a pluralistic society can enjoy religious freedom. The leaders must pledge to rule in a secular manner and follow through. A small adaptation to the official oaths would make it easy. For example, the current presidential oath of office reads, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Simply append, as the supreme law of the land to the end. There, this is my kind of religious test. Say yes to the supremacy of the Constitution as the law of the land, or go become a preacher instead. That's a big step. And until we get there, asking your politicians if they agree with Article 6 of the Constitution, which specifies that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, even above religious texts, is a great way to learn about their priorities and whether they place your rights above or below their religion. On Jewish atheism. I've said in the past that Judaism is both a religion and a culture. At various stages in my life, I have been committed to this idea. For example, my wife Hildy and I sent our daughter to a Workman's Circle Jewish school, which taught Jewish culture and Jewish religion from a historical perspective. Our ancestors believed in a God that did this. Our ancestors believed in a God that said that. This is a laki. This is how you dance the hora. This all made sense to me at the time because I considered Judaism to be both a race and a religion separable from each other. I have since concluded that I was wrong when I tried to justify Jewish atheism for this book and failed. During this period, I discussed the issue with my friend Penn Jillette, who has long called Jewish atheism bullshit. He calls lots of things that. Noting that any genetic bonds Jews have with each other are actually only tied to specific regions of descent, not a commonality called being Jewish. He opined that since you can't convert to being black or Italian, but you can convert to being Jewish, they can't be the same thing. Penn is married to Emily, some of whose family members insist that not only is Emily Jewish, but so are her kids, due to Judaism's matrilineal descent dogma, which states that all children of Jewish women are Jewish by birth. They are all Jews, according to Judaism, even though Emily herself rejects the term and the kids aren't being raised with any such concept or exposure. Penn wrote to me, "They try to claim my children as Jewish by Jewish law. They say I have no choice." I became more and more confused about the whole Jewish atheism thing as I thought and wrote about it. My words were inconsistent, and when I took what I wrote and changed the word Jewish to Muslim or any other religion, I found myself unable to reconcile what defines Jewish identity without the religious aspects. One event in particular helped further clarify my views. During my first Passover after my mom died, I watched my wife perform the Seder, the ritual service and meal, and I realized that Passover in my mind had nothing to do with my ancestors whatsoever. They celebrated the holiday in quite a different manner from us. My mother's Seders when I was growing up were lax religiously, as opposed to the ones apparently led by my Orthodox great-grandmother. Indeed, my family's Passover wasn't ancient at all. With its recently established family traditions, it bore little resemblance to its predecessors. It was a lot less religious and a lot more mom, food, and family-centric. Picture Thanksgiving with different food, a 10-minute service led by my Uncle Harvey, who didn't have a yarmulke, so he wore a napkin on his head, and 5 cups of wine, making that napkin yarmulke the funniest thing ever. As I sat there, now motherless and uncle-less, watching my wife lead the Seder, I realized how different it was from that of my upbringing, just because my family had evolved. Both were celebrations of the same Jewish holiday, but what exactly did that mean? What is Jewish? And how different was my family's Jewishness to my great-grandparents? And how can such blatant differences be so profoundly ignored? Where does Judaism start and family tradition end? Where is the Jew in secular Jew? A second clarifying experience happened at a science museum, where I observed an Islamic display. Curious, I wandered into the display, only to see the same theme over and over. Here's a person, this person invented a thing, this person was a Muslim, and therefore Islam gave the world this invented thing. As I went from person to person in the display, I became bitter at Islam for taking credit for the accomplishments of its adherents. I realized it is similar to Jews proudly crowing about all the Jewish Nobel Prize winners as if Judaism, and not a whole slew of other factors, was somehow uniquely responsible. This is just religion trying to make itself look more relevant and important by claiming credit where credit is not due. Then I realized that Judaism is simply doing the same thing with regard to Jewish culture and ethnicity, taking credit where it is simply not due in an effort to make itself look more important. For example, there is no such thing as Jewish food or dance. For the most part, these traditions are all based on national or local traditions that have little to do with religion. They don't make bagels Jewish any more than falafel is Muslim or chow mein is Buddhist. Almost everything non-religious commonly known to be Jewish is actually specific to only one sect of Jews from the Eastern European nations called the Ashkenazim. If the culture were Jewish, it would include a large number of non-Ashkenazi Jews as well. But this is not the case. Whole sects of Jews have no association at all with Jewish culture. Nobody associates bagels and lox with Ethiopian Jews because it's not part of their culture. So it's not Jewish culture by definition, but rather Eastern European culture, with Judaism simply taking the credit. And then there's the issue of matrilineal descent, which determines who is part of the Jewish race in the most non-scientific way possible. Someone decided it should be that way and declared it true. Matrilineal descent claims any child of a Jewish mother is a Jew by blood. The father is not considered in this determination, which invalidates any claims to a race because we all know genes from both parents make up the genetic inheritance of the offspring. For example, when a person of Asian descent has a child with a person of African descent, you don't get a pure Asian or African child. You get a mixed-race child. Matrilineal descent implies racial purity despite the reality of dilution. Despite this, if your mother is Jewish and your father is not, you're considered Jewish by most Jews, not a half-Jew. As my daughter Winter puts it, that's not a thing. Genes don't follow human dogma. That it's matrilineal and not patrilineal itself is simply a choice someone once made and codified into Jewish law. This rule isn't divine, nor is it scientific. It's imagined. So this means, in this world, some people are Jewish who would not be Jewish if whoever decided on the matrilineal versus patrilineal descent had made the opposite choice and all the same breeding had occurred. Similarly, some non-Jews today would be Jews if their father's blood had been the determining factor. So, some people are only Jewish or non-Jewish because of the choice some people made a long time ago. There is nothing, nothing uniquely and universally physical about Jewishness. So it's not in the blood at all. And to complicate matters, certain segments of Judaism changed their minds in modern times and began recognizing matrilineal or patrilineal descent as equally valid for claiming a child is Jewish. Now it is possible for people who consider themselves to have been born and raised Jewish to be Jewish in every single way, including religious practice, to be told they aren't Jewish by members of another segment of Jews, that in fact I, the atheist who has denounced Judaism, am a real Jew by virtue of my mother's having been Jewish, and my believing, practicing counterparts are not because their mother was a non-Jew. That's ridiculous. In fact, these Eastern European Jews, according to Aaron Elhake, a geneticist at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, are mostly the descendants of converts with no genetic linkage to ancient Judea. No link, genetic or otherwise, exists with other sects of Judaism. All genetic similarities between Eastern European Jews are native to Eastern Europe. Indeed, according to Elhake, there is no Jewish genome, and there is certainly no Jewish gene. My thoughts as they stand now are that my link to Judaism is just a result of my immediate family's upbringing, and the religion of Judaism is taking the credit. The Jewish race is looking a lot more like a tradition and nothing more among some Jews to call Judaism a race. Once again, religion is taking the credit for something that it does not deserve so as to benefit itself by inflating its membership. The whole Jewish atheism concept seems merely a defense mechanism for Judaism to protect itself against atheism or conversion, much as circumcising a boy at 8 days of age brands the child so he will always be marked as a member of the Jewish people. If your atheist kids were told they were Jewish by birth and got older and went through a religious phase, they'd likely turn to Judaism as opposed to whatever other faith they might have chosen. It's like an insurance policy. Come on in, there's no conversion needed for you, you're already one of us. If you're going to try out a religion, start with your roots. Moreover, the false notion of a race keeps people self-identifying as Jews despite a total abandonment of the religion. It works. Approximately half the people who call themselves Jews are atheists, hiding the truth about their atheism. Additionally, these atheists who buy into the secular Jew concept still give allegiance and financial support to Jewish and Zionist organizations, bolstering theistic Judaism with money via guilt and misinformation. Israel is a huge benefactor of the lie of the Jewish race, inciting passionate support globally from people who think their people are in danger and that a country with a state church of Judaism is vitally important to their preservation. It's a fantastic scam that leads to huge amounts of money flooding into Israel, including from America, all made possible by the lie that Judaism is more than just another religion. Softer, less tangible terms such as culture and ethnicity and the idea that all Jews today are connected through the Holocaust are just further attempts to justify clinging to the idea that Judaism is something more than it is. It's almost ex-parrot-esque in its attempt to justify grouping all descendants of Jews as Jews even after they dump their religion. Cultures can be abandoned, but when you try to leave Judaism, you are told you can't leave because it's in your blood, which is a lie. Ethnicities are location-centric, but since Judaism has strains from many different areas of the globe, and the different strains share no commonalities except a religion, ethnicity is the wrong word too. Those who call Judaism a culture, ethnicity, or nationality are ignoring that some Jews have no ties to this culture, ethnicity, or nationality. Jews from different regions, Ashkenazim, Sephardim, Ethiopian, etc., have very different cultures and continue to separate themselves from each other. Are they all Jews? Yes, because they all have the Torah in common, until they drop the Torah and become atheists, who happen to be children of Jews. As to the guilt-laden, we are all linked by the Holocaust, so don't denounce Judaism because that is what Hitler would want routine. The truth is neither the Holocaust, the Spanish Inquisition, nor all of the other attempts at eliminating Jews combined make Judaism more than a religion. Nor does it give me the responsibility to pretend I'm something I'm not. I'm not morally obligated to continue the race, tradition, or whatever just because it's what Hitler would have hated. The Holocaust should not be a tool to spread the lie Hitler wrongly used to his advantage. Reality, and being honest about it, cannot be a betrayal. The truly broadest definition I've ever heard for what is a Jew is that Jews are the people anti-Semites and Hitler hate. In other words, these Jews are defining themselves as Jews because ignorant bigots call them Jews and hate them for it, thereby allowing themselves to be defined by the people who hate them rather than by what the evidence shows us. When I hear this, I hear a person desperately reaching to find a way to make Judaism more than a religion. What's more, most non-Jews don't understand the concepts of secular Judaism or humanistic Judaism. As I showed earlier, 70% of Americans don't understand the term secular, and nearly 90% don't understand humanist. So when they hear it, they assume the norm, theism, the exact opposite of the truth. In this very real way, atheists who call themselves Jews of any kind are calling themselves theists as far as most listeners are concerned. So I am reminded that we are all victims of indoctrination, and I am no different. I was taught a lie that Judaism is more than it is, and I stuck by it without examining its veracity because I was taught not to. There's no way around it. I was suckered into defending a false idea in the same way theists are suckered into their false ideas. It took this book, in which I originally attempted to justify Jewish atheism on paper, to conquer my cognitive dissonance on the subject. I don't call myself Jewish anymore. I realized that when someone asks me if I'm Jewish, saying anything but no, I'm an atheist will yield misleading information and derail the conversation from where I want it to go. So call me an atheist. The Jewish thing just seems like, as Penn would say, bullshit. If you're an atheist and you still call yourself a Jew, please reconsider what's important and what's true. On Islam and religion-inspired terrorism. Fight and kill the disbelievers wherever you find them, take them captive, harass them, lie in wait and ambush them using every stratagem of war. Quran chapter 9, verse 5. Bring forth him that hath cursed without the camp, and let all that heard him lay their hands upon his head, and let the congregation stone him. Leviticus 24:14. I'm sometimes called Islamophobic, and while I do admit to fearing some major factions of Islam, I don't like the connotation or the politically correct assertion that such fear is irrational. Concerns about Islam are very different from, for example, concerns about Judaism, because Islam is unique among religions today in posing a real threat to the human condition. I would go so far as to say an educated fear is a completely rational position. It's not about race. Islam is not a race. And it's not about people, victims. It's about an ancient and particularly violent desert religious sect, separated from society and honed over generations by a destructive religious cycle into a barbaric nightmare that, unlike Christianity and Judaism, has yet to be tempered by modern values, due to that very separation. Islam was born in the desert, where food and water were scarce and life was cutthroat. According to Dr. Wafa Sultan, psychiatrist, author, and critic of Islam, quote, raiding was the only means of survival. The tribes fought one another in their quest for water and food. Then Islam came and tried to regularize raiding operations, justifying raids by its prophet and followers, but proscribing raids by others. Islam tried to justify these raids by regarding them as death in God's cause, end quote. According to Dr. Sultan, Islam is a religion founded in justifying violence in the name of its God. One can easily imagine how such a beginning might yield a religion with a very different character from a religion formed in an agrarian or fishing society where gods provided ample food and water. Since then, like other religions, it has splintered, fractured, and evolved into many sects of varying beliefs, each of which calls itself true Islam, but all stemming from the same basic beliefs and lore which, according to Sultan, yields a commonality of thinking among Muslims. Quote, Muslims eat raiding, dress raiding, talk raiding, and drive their cars like raiders, end quote. That last sentence is too broad a generalization for my taste, but I can see the point. A religion formed in a brutal environment, where whole communities lived and died by stealing from each other, glorified raiding and conquest as central in its teachings, which makes it different, yes, more barbaric, than other religions at its core. According to the most popular version of Islam, you may not draw the Prophet Muhammad's face or representation, and you may not portray him on stage. In September of 2005, when Danish cartoonists dared to disobey this command, riots or protests occurred in nearly every country with a Muslim majority, and the brainwashed followers of this barbaric religion killed more than 100 people over the comics of their prophet. The world gasped and then caved en masse. The ability we once had to draw Muhammad, see his picture, or poke fun at him in any way evaporated, and the world started obeying Islamic law just a little. Suddenly, most people viewed depicting Muhammad as an act of provocation, not expression. American atheists embraced Draw Muhammad Day, where, again, all we did was disobey someone else's demands to follow their religion's primitive tenets, and we were called instigators. I disagree. Islam was the instigator by telling me that I have to follow its arbitrary rule in the first place. I have the right to draw anything I want, and I'm defending it by doing it in defiance. We were not alone in our opposition to this prohibition. Nationwide and worldwide, other atheist and free speech organizations opposed this PC-cloaked censorship and continued to draw Muhammad and criticize Islam. Then, on January 7, 2015, Islamic militants launched another attack on our right to express ourselves, storming the headquarters of the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo, murdering 12 people. With shouts of, "We have avenged the Prophet!" These religion-made murderers killed people as a punishment for printing cartoons of Muhammad. The world mourned. In huge demonstrations of solidarity, people finally began to understand that their rights were being threatened and stood together screaming, "Je suis Charlie!" But the U.S. press still caved and would not do what it needed to do, show the cartoons that the shooters used to justify the murders. Defy their demands, we complained, and the social media shares of the comics were indeed huge. But the mainstream press acquiesced again, largely refusing to show the cartoons out of fear, cloaked as respect. Most recently, on May 3, 2015, two Islamic militants opened fire on unarmed civilians inside the U.S. in Garland, Texas, where a group was hosting a Draw Muhammad contest. Yes, the people who were holding the event knew they were being provocative, but no, that does not make the shooting their fault in any way. Americans see attacks and riots over such depictions of Muhammad and fear for their fellow humans. In response, citizens of the United States, the country that defined freedom of speech, obey these repressive demands and criticize those who do not. They may not fear for their own lives, but they fear for others globally, and their empathy makes them respond by obeying and pressuring others to obey. The anticipated guilt they would feel if they were to break the code of the all-peaceful Prophet Muhammad and terror riots or shootings were to erupt where innocent people could die because of their actions makes them comply. That's yielding to terrorism. But let's be clear. The people depicting or drawing Muhammad are not responsible in any way, shape, or form for any riots or deaths that might occur. The rioters and the killers are. Willingly submitting to this religious prescription amounts to yielding to terrorism, and recoiling in the face of this violence only teaches the terrorists that they have an effective tool to curtail our most basic rights. In short, obeying in the face of violence begets more rules to obey under more threats of more violence. If a mob of atheists went on a killing spree every time someone burned a picture of Charles Darwin, who would deserve blame for the deaths? The picture burners? No. The people to blame for killing sprees are the killers. Just as Theo van Gogh, assassinated for making a film with Ayaan Hirsi Ali that was critical of Islam, was not to blame for his own murder, neither are the Danish cartoonists nor the newspaper that printed their cartoons, even remotely. The rioters were the killers and bear all the blame. Can we agree on that? If you say something to offend me, I mean really offend me, so I take out a gun and shoot you, is your death your own fault? Did you deserve it? No. The people expressing their opinions, like the organizers of the Draw Muhammad contest, hold zero responsibility over the actions of those who disagree. When fanatics say, obey our religious laws even if you're not a believer, the immediate response must be to break whatever religious laws they are talking about. Don't draw Muhammad? Here's a picture. Don't criticize Islam? Hell yes, I'll say what I think. If militant Muslims riot and kill people, they are to blame. We are not to blame for exercising our rights. That can simply never be the case. It's pretty sad that Islamic fanatics think that we would give up any portion of our right to freedom of expression, press, and speech, but that's exactly what they're demanding. It's sadder still that in many cases they are right. Nobody seems to be complaining except atheists, and only the firebrands at that, while the politically correct crowd chastises us for being too in-your-face and calls us names. Meanwhile, people relinquish their rights readily and eagerly in a quest for peace with religious fanatics that will never be realized. Case in point, let's look at Bill Donahue, president of the Almost Always Wrong Catholic League, blaming the victims for the Charlie Hebdo shooting in a manner that I can only describe as pandering to fanatics. In this case, it's a rather obvious attempt to leverage the shooting to quell criticism of his own failing faith. Quote, killing in response to insult, no matter how gross, must be unequivocally condemned. That is why what happened in Paris cannot be tolerated. But neither should we tolerate the kind of intolerance that provoked this violent reaction. Those who work at this newspaper have a long and disgusting record of going way beyond the mere lampooning of figures, and this is especially true of their depictions of religious figures. Stéphane Charbonnier, the paper's publisher, was killed today in the slaughter. It's too bad that he didn't understand the role he played in his tragic death. Indeed, it seems a majority of Americans are eager to give up rights in exchange for peace with radical Islamists. They don't even consider that rights are lost in increments, and if we allow our country to obey some part of Islamic law, the same militants will use these successful tactics to force obeyance of their next law, and the next, and so on. Notice how the 2005 demands of "Do not draw Muhammad" have now broadened to become "Do not insult Islam." Restrictions grow in baby steps. Giving into terrorism will yield more terrorism because it works. The way to defeat terrorism of this nature is to show that it doesn't work. The way you show it doesn't work is to continue to break as many of Islam's laws as possible, and even more so after terror riots and murders occur. In the paper version of the book, I have a stick figure of a smiley face labeled "Not the Prophet Muhammad." That "not" wasn't there at first. Security and business concerns made its addition compulsory. Terrorism, as we all know, is real, and the damage caused by it is real. And while I am happy and eager to defend my right to draw Muhammad, I would place bookstore owners and people who work for my publisher in jeopardy without that "not." Ridiculous, isn't it? A smiley face labeled Muhammad may conceivably be used to excuse murders. Notice how I didn't say cause murders. In short, I had to yield to terrorism to publish this book, and I'm angry about it. For the record, I openly and wholeheartedly endorse people drawing Muhammad. I admit to doing it myself and state definitively that I will do it again. And if anyone kills me because I do it, I hope that you, dear listeners, will pick up the slack and continue the tradition. Indeed, my safety depends on the terrorists knowing that such is exactly what will happen. Rights are lost if not protected, and drawing Muhammad is not the last step in radical Islam's terror campaign to place its laws above our rights as Americans. Yesterday, we couldn't draw Muhammad. Today, we can't criticize or insult Islam at all. What's next? The next step is forced, feigned respect. My answer is always no, and I hope you will stand with me on this very important issue. Some people will counter my drawing of Muhammad with an assertion that I am offending a billion people. To this I reply with 2 points. 1. We didn't start drawing Muhammad until we were told we could not. This is not about offending Muslims. Otherwise, we would have been doing this all along. This is about protecting our rights, and it is they who are insulting and offending me and us when they insist we obey their ridiculous religious laws. 2. I would gladly offend a billion people in exchange for protecting a single right. People get offended all the time and they get over it. However, rights, once lost, are usually gone for good and, again, are rarely the last rights you lose. Having rights is more important than not offending people, and protecting rights is far more important than being nice or respectful to those who wish to take even the least of our rights away. Jews, as a counterexample, don't like it when we spell out the name of their God in Hebrew. I was reminded of this when I did just that for a Hebrew billboard American Atheists put up in Brooklyn. More about this in Chapter 9 on the Reason Rally. I received a call from a synagogue requesting to take ownership of the vinyl after the billboard came down so it could be disposed of in their preferred method. However, not once was I told not to dispose of the billboard myself or that I needed to obey Jewish law. The synagogue just wanted to dispose of the imprint of their holy name in its own way. Not enough, though, because I offered to sell the vinyl for what I paid and the synagogue passed, so I just threw it away. No harm, no foul. Of course, if the Jewish population were trying to prevent us from writing something through laws or terror rioting, I would be writing whatever they proscribed because that, like the prescription against the drawing of Muhammad, would be an attempt to reduce our freedom and lead us further into theocracy. The answer would be no. In summary, I draw Muhammad. I spell the name of the Jewish God. And I otherwise do as I see fit without regard to other people's religious laws. Political correctness and religion's archaic and arbitrary rules do not stop me, and neither should they stop you. When religion demands you refrain from doing something otherwise benign, that's just a provocation to do it more. There is no argument that Islam creates many terrorists, subjugates women, and brainwashes children. But while Islam may present the biggest and most obvious threat, Christianity and Judaism are not innocent. Sure, Christianity isn't breeding too many terrorists today, unless you actually count. Anders Breivik, who murdered 77 people in July of 2011, including children, in Norway after creating a 1,500-page Christian manifesto and identifying himself as a Christian crusader, who Bill O'Reilly quickly proclaimed was not a Christian. Eric Rudolph, Christian American terrorist and Olympic Park bomber. Timothy McVeigh, the Christian Oklahoma City bomber. Globally, Christianity spurs hate, division, and murder, as it has throughout history. Consider the establishment of the death penalty for private homosexual acts in Uganda, the promotion of the spread of AIDS due to Catholic prohibition against condoms, particularly in Africa. And let's not forget that political war between the Catholics and the Protestants that killed thousands in Northern Ireland. And then there's Judaism, which, apart from participating in a never-ending war over the tiny piece of land it and Christianity and Islam calls holy, also hosts among its Orthodox the barbaric practice of some moils, ritual circumcisers, of sucking the blood from a baby's penis following circumcision. A different kind of oral tradition called Metzitza Pepeh that can spread the deadly herpes virus to newborns. In 2013, Rabbi David Niederman, executive director of the Hasidic United Jewish Organizations of Williamsburg, told ABC News, quote, "If, God forbid, there was a danger, we would be the first to stop the practice." Of course, now that 13 children have been infected with herpes, some of whom died while others have suffered brain damage, the rabbis are still defending this horrific practice. Additionally, in 2011, in response to the brutal murder of an 8-year-old child, Ben Hirsch, president of Survivors for Justice, reported, "For decades, Brooklyn's Hasidic leadership has been protecting pedophiles. This is going to sound shocking, but the safest place for a sex offender to reside is within the Hasidic and strictly Orthodox community employed as a teacher. As for Catholicism, do I have to even mention the pedophile priest scandal spanning decades, or the genocidal history of the Inquisitions, or support of the Nazi extermination of the Jews by the ironically named Pope Pius XII, and so on from the moment the so-called Holy See was established? Religion breeds extremism by its very nature. Every spin-off, every cult, every zealot has the potential to do evil in the name of their gods, and we must all recognize that. Yes, Islam is a problem, but Jews and Christians have nothing about which to crow and are in no position to judge because they all have histories of barbaric acts done in the name of their religion. Yes, atheist dictators such as Stalin have done horrible things, as have Christian dictators such as Charles Taylor and Mobutu Seko. But this isn't about bad people doing bad things. It's about evil deeds committed in the name of religion. It's rampant and widespread, and every major religion has blood on its hands. Hinduism, classism, and fatalism run amok. I would be remiss if I didn't also talk about the horrible classism incarnate that is Hinduism. While not nearly as prevalent in America as the Abrahamic religions, Hinduism is the oldest religion in the world, with estimates of its age exceeding 6,000 years. According to ZNews India, there are over 1 billion Hindu people. Quote, "Hinduism is the third largest religion in the world after Christianity and Islam, and 97% of all Hindus live in three Hindu-majority countries, India, Nepal, and Mauritius." End quote. Here in America, our sheltered view of Hinduism usually conjures up images of vegetarianism, yoga, and tantric sex. But these niceties hide an undercurrent of rampant intolerance and stifled primitive behavior. Hinduism has several main gods and millions of smaller ones, which some say are all manifestations of one primary deity. Like so many other religions, Hinduism has deeply ingrained misogyny and gender bias. Like so many other religions, Hinduism has a long history of violence against other religions and between its sects. However, None of this is what makes Hinduism so unusually abhorrent. That honor comes from the concepts of fatalism and reincarnation. Hinduism asserts that a person is reincarnated after death and born into a new life that reflects how good a Hindu the person was in the past life. If you are a good Hindu in this life, your reward in the next life is a richer and happier life. If you are bad, you can be born a poorer, lower caste person, or worse, an animal. The caste system is a manifestation of this sentiment. Upper caste members have better jobs and more money. Lower caste members are the community's impoverished and uneducated. Whatever your situation is, whether it's a position of wealth or poverty, health or illness, it is what the gods have determined you deserve. Think about how this affects adherence. It obliterates compassion for the poor, empathy for the underprivileged, and responsibility to help the needy. After all, they deserve what the gods have bestowed upon them. The rich have no responsibility to help out because they also deserve their good fortune, and they wouldn't want to displease the gods that punish the poor lest they be downgraded in the next life. The division is stark and permanent. If you are in a lower caste, an upper caste person might think nothing of kicking you in the street if you are in the way. Lower caste members are sometimes referred to as untouchables because upper casters feel them so vile that they will not even cross shadows with them for fear of defilement. As a result, untouchables might not even be able to find jobs as maids and servants of the rich because the rich won't permit them in their homes. I've heard a story of rich people with dirty toilets because the rich are too pompous to clean their own, but they will not allow members of lower castes into their homes to do the work either. Moreover, a person's place in the caste system is permanent, again because the gods have determined that people are in the right places. This eliminates striving for betterment. It stifles attempts or even dreams of improving your lifestyle. If you are lower caste, you will stay there, as will all of your descendants. There is no way up. Lower caste members need to obey the rules and maintain the status quo for their whole lives in the hopes of moving up in caste in the next life. There is no mixed caste marriage, and on the off chance one occurs, the couple is sometimes exiled or executed. In his book Culture Can Kill, Subodh Shah describes how Hinduism's fatalism has stifled Indian society. Quote, "Fatalism is worse than laziness. It provides us with philosophical foundations to justify our laziness and failures, imparts an aura of respectability to our inactivity and passivity, and shuts out hard work as a possible choice. If my life is beyond my purview, why bother being industrious or ambitious? Even if I bother, will it help? Do we have the power to shape our destiny? The answer from the populist culture of fatalism is a resounding no. How can this culture ever have a motivation to strive, struggle, win, or advance?" End quote. Moreover, and an obvious part of the scam, Hindus place the concept of faith above intelligence. Indeed, the religion of Hinduism looks down on intelligence as an evil force to be avoided. Shah continues, quote, "Hindu theosophy assigns intelligence a much lower place than faith, even when it pays lip service to intelligence. Unquestionable faith in gurus, scriptures, saints, and mythology is routinely advocated, emphasized, and assumed. Absurd myths are preached, defended, and believed under various pretexts. These encourage irrationality that becomes a habit of the mind in the populace. Irrational attitudes imparted to children become entrenched through life. Popular culture makes non-reason legitimate and acceptable. Pious people in India believe that intelligence is a hindrance in matters of religion. To them, reason or even skepticism is not only undesirable, it is an unmitigated evil." End quote. Finally, as one might predict, the pedestal on which the Hindu leaders, swamis and gurus, sit enables rampant abuse, much of it sexual. A simple Google search yields instance after instance of gurus being gods to their followers. Remember, Hinduism has millions of gods, some of which are self-deified gurus, using their position to have sex with followers. I added this section to illustrate the breadth of the problem of religion, even among those many people wrongly believed to be benign. One can easily see how the 6,000-year religion cycle has evolved an ancient myth into a powerful force for classism. Hinduism, like other religions, seeks expansion and government protection and demands respect, but deserves none. The lie of God goes way beyond Abraham. The Bad Atheists. I've spent most of this chapter talking about religion, and over I've restated that when I do, I'm not calling out individual people. Now I must take a break from beating that drum to talk about people who, as individuals, deserve to be held in low regard because they are not the victims, they are the liars, and they are atheists. I wish we could look at the broad spectrum of atheists and say we are all on the same side, pushing for our own equality, but this is not the case. Many atheists are simply working against us, usually for their personal gain. The most obvious of these are the atheist televangelists and other preachers who spread lies for money without regard for truth, fairness, or justice. They are the true stereotype, immoral liars who convince the uneducated victims in their flocks to donate their hard-earned money in the name of a god the preacher knows very well does not exist. Now, I'm not talking about those preachers trapped in their jobs who can't get out. I'm talking about the ones who make money in the name of their gods, fooling their flocks, often teaching that atheists are bad, damned, and worthy of contempt. Imagine the immorality of being an atheist pretending to be pious and teaching people to hate honest atheists for personal gain. Remember the reasoning that I used for our friends in Washington. If they believe in hell and an all-seeing judge, and if they speak to, with, through this God, they'd be pretty stupid or insane to risk repeated affairs or other wrongdoings. So let's expose some preachers to the same logic. George Wreckers, a vocal anti-gay activist in the name of God before he was caught taking a trip to Europe with a man he allegedly rented from a website in May of 2010. Ted Haggard, another anti-gay pastor who allegedly paid for gay sex over 3 years with a man from whom he admittedly bought methamphetamine in 2006. Jim Baker. In 1980, he was involved in a sex scandal with Jessica Hahn, and he was convicted in 1989 of bilking followers out of over $158 million. Harold Camping. He was sure the world was going to end in May of 2011. He might have been insane, but given that he'd never apologized for being wrong, and 2011 was his third such prediction, I think he was probably a liar. A liar worth $75 million. Peter Popov. Claimed to be getting signals from heaven about the pain people in his audience were experiencing. How did he know? He was getting a signal from his wife with a radio transmitter through a hidden earpiece. He was exposed in 1986, with recordings and all, on national TV by James Randi. Popoff still preaches, though, and he still has followers. But you tell me, is this the mind of a true believer, an insane person, or a liar who has no fear of lying in the name of God? Whoever says, I know him, but does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. John chapter 2, verse 4. It is repugnant to accept, but we must. Some of the worst people in religion are atheists, and we have to own that to keep our perspective. Just like religion, atheism does not innately yield integrity. On the subject of integrity, our final adversary is the least palatable but still useful, the apologetic atheist. These are atheists who apologize to the theists for being atheists or for other atheist behavior. These are people like S.E. Cupp, who has gone on record as saying she would never vote for an atheist like herself, and she wishes she were a theist. Quote, I envy religious people. I envy the faithful. I would like to be a person of faith, but I'm not there yet. End quote. Malcolm X seethed with anger at what he called Uncle Thomas Blacks, who reinforced white supremacy for their own selfish betterment by working within the white establishment, having achieved an elevated status due to their acquiescence, without trying to change it. They vocally approved of segregation and other poor treatment of blacks by whites by agreeing with and repeating the twisted logic that white people used to support it. Here we see Cupp doing the same thing, sitting among the religionists claiming she is an atheist while saying it's okay to be bigoted against atheists, to wit, quote, And you know what? I would never vote for an atheist president, ever, because I do not think that someone who represents 5 or 10% of the population should be representing and thinking that everyone else in the world is crazy but me. I like that there's a check, okay? That there's a person in the office that doesn't think he's bigger than the state. I like religion being a check and knowing that my president goes home every night addressing someone above him and not thinking that all the power resides right here. Atheists don't have that. End quote. Whether Cupp is actually an atheist remains to be seen. Note that I'm not there yet comment. What does that say to you? My fake psychic powers tell me she's planning to convert to Christianity and write a book sometime in the near future, which will spread bigotry against atheists, increase the level of ignorance about us, and make her a megaton of money. If I were an immoral Christian posing as an atheist to help Christianity, or an immoral atheist looking to make a ton of cash, that's what I'd do. The payday would be huge. Another side to Ms. Cupp's position is in the no such thing as bad press category. She certainly does get the word atheist out to one of our target markets. She doesn't set a good example, but she does put atheism and the reality of our existence in front of people. And much to our own chagrin, we must admit this has value. When Christian S.E. Cupp fans meet another atheist, there will likely be less of an anti-atheist knee-jerk reaction because they know of at least one atheist they like. In-groups are powerful things. They allow good people who are Christians to protect bad people who are Christians. They allow good people who are Jews to defend bad people who are Jews. We must not be like that if we are to be ethical and logical people. Bad atheists exist, and they deserve no special treatment or regard just because they are atheists. If we are to be the good guys, we must begin by demanding good behavior even from within atheism. Atheism is broad, and our ranks span the gamut of politics and ethical positions. I'm all for that breadth, but let's not allow our in-group to be about atheists that hurt people or hurt our country and our cause via deceit and lies. We must internalize that atheists can be assholes just like religionists, and all are responsible for their own actions. None get a free ride because they are on our side of the religion fence. Criminals need to go to jail, and liars need to get called out. Ethics first. The reason there are good Muslims who credit their goodness to their religion and bad Muslims who credit their evil, which they think is good, to the same religion is the same reason why both good and bad Christians, good and bad Jews, and the rest all push their holy books as the source of their good or bad activity. They're all wrong. If the Bible and other holy books were at all reliable sources of morality, good and bad religious people wouldn't both be able to point to their holy books as guidance and inspiration to support their positions. If morality is completely separable from religion, we would expect to see exactly what we do: people making their own moral decisions and then ascribing that morality to their particular holy book. They use their scripture as a shield to both defend their actions and to insulate themselves from criticism. Bottom line, you don't need anybody telling you what is good. You are probably already good. You are definitely already godless, because there are no gods.